Für alle ein Fest. Zum Aldi-Tiefpreis. Diese Woche Wintertraumplätzchen XXL. 600 Gramm für nur 2,79 Euro. Oder meine Metzgerei Hähnchen-Minutenschnitzel. 400 Gramm für nur 3,59 Euro. Entdecke viele weitere festliche Angebote. Jetzt bei Aldi Nord. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
It's the Bill Simmons Podcast presented by The Ringer Podcast Network, where you can find Zach Lowe's podcast.
Whoa.
Big free agent edition the beginning of April. Now we're in a hotel room in Indiana. We just watched a stunning NBA Finals Game 3. We have a very fancy tech setup. We're in my hotel room. I have my camera facing me. I have Zach's iPad facing him. They said we would have needed a video crew, right? We'd have people here. We'd have mics. We don't need that.
We have cups with strings if need be attached to each other.
You know what? We belong to the people. We can just put this together. We can just do this like the common man. We just watched an incredible game. Ringer Podcast Network. Check out the rewatchables. We put up Working Girl. When are you going to be in the rewatchables, by the way?
No one asked me. People ask me this question. Just ask me.
Well, you have to come to LA is the problem.
I love Los Angeles.
Okay. Well, you're going to be in the rewatchables at some point. Anyway, coming up, we're going to talk about an incredible game 3 that we both went to. It's all next. Let's take a break and we'll bring in Pearl Jam. This episode is presented by State Farm. It's no secret that great teams need great teammates. I've been saying this for years. And when it comes to insurance, State Farm is there to help you find the right coverage for your home, car, and more. Whether you need an in-person or digital assist, they're ready when life hits you with a full court press. Get a game plan that helps fit your life. Talk to State Farm today. State Farm with the assist. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability and eligibility vary by state. All right, Zach Lowe, it is 11:43 Eastern time. We are in Indianapolis, Indiana, a wonderful place. I had a great time today. Everybody's super friendly. People love this Pacers team. There was a sense of, boy, it would be adorable if they could just get a couple punches in. We kind of know where this series is going. Around the third quarter, I started to get flashbacks to the 2011 finals when I was in Dallas. A Dallas team that did not make a lot of sense. And they're playing Miami. First year of LeBron, Wade, Bosh. Just waiting for Miami to finish them off. And there's a point with the crowd and the energy and shots are going in and defensive plays where you kind of go, huh, what's going on here? And Indiana wins and they're up 2-1. They're 2 games away from the 2025 NBA title, Zach Lowe.
I'll tell you this right now. I was at Pacers practice yesterday. I've been around the Pacers a lot in the last 3 weeks. The whole, like, we're playing with house money thing. It'd be nice if we got a punch or two in. None of that is filtered into them. They're like, oh, yeah, we can win. Like, we're as good as this team. We can beat this team. Like, none of that is applying to them. And I, you know, the whole discussion in the last 48, 72 hours has been, I've seen like a million stories. You've talked about it with Ryan. Where does this team rank? And like, is the most unusual potential champion, the most unusual finalist, you know, blah, 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 preseason odds. It's time to start just shifting the discussion to something happened. And this is now a championship level team, because regardless of what happens from here on out, they are up 2-1 in the NBA finals over a 68 win team. And that game tonight didn't feel fluky. It felt like two teams trading punches, a little ugly, a little grimy. People got tired. Some bad shots were taken. Some tough defensive possessions were inflicted by both teams. And they made enough big plays. The bench was unbelievable. But like, the most unusual thing, like, that's cool. It's going to be good trivia, whether they win or lose. But like, something happened to this team and they're just this good.
First half, the basketball was about as high level as you're going to get for a game 3 of the finals. Usually, it takes a couple games. That was like a game 4, game 5 level. It's like, oh, they're going toe-to-toe. They're doing all the benches are coming in and actually making an impact. They're running really smart offense. They're attacking the other side like they've seen them for a bunch of games. I was halftime, I was just really impressed. Like talking to the people in my section, Tommy came over. We were just like, that was just a good basketball game.
Jesus. Tommy Alter?
Tommy Alter stopped
just,
by.
Just ubiquitous.
Wearing a Roots of Fight jacket. Just super happy to be in Indiana. Third quarter starts.
6-0 run Thunder. Boom.
And OKC comes out with some real physicality and some swagger. And it was like, all right, that was cute. That was a fun run by Indiana, and just felt like it was going to go the way of all these other OKC games. And once again, they climbed out of the hole. Haliburton was great. I don't want to do the Haliburton stepped up thing because I thought that was the worst storyline of the week. And I thought it was a fundamental misunderstanding of who Haliburton is as a player, a guy who takes 13 to 14 shots a game, who averages 19-9 during the season and 19-9 in the playoffs. He is who he is. This is Steve Nash in the mid-2000s was like this. Chris Paul in the late 2000s and 2010s were like this. These guys are not built to score 22 shots a game. They're not 30-point scorers. They make everyone else better. That's the whole point of having them. They set the tone. They drive the car. You want to put them in an awesome car and let them do their thing. With that said, I thought he was a little more aggressive in the first half.
No question.
He clearly was like, I can't let whatever happened last game happen again. So he took a couple shots that weren't even great shots, but it was just, he was trying to get in the paint and he was trying to take more stuff. But I thought he wasn't just awesome on offense. His hands were everywhere on defense. I don't know how many balls he touched, deflected, stole, but it felt like he was all over the place.
Yeah, he had a pick six against Shea. Shea had a couple bad pass turnovers that went the other way. 6 turnovers for Shea.
Oof.
Indiana wins the turnover battle. That's step one to having any chance of beating the Thunder is like not just not lose it by too much. They won it. I like Haliburton. I remember a long two he took over at SGA in the first half. That was clearly just like an ISO. Like, they want me to move more aggressive. This is like, I got to take this shot. He took a couple threes where he just kind of pulled up like in like, before using a screen or in between a switch, like I got a little window, I got to take it. Like I can't afford not to take it. But
yep.
The other stat is, and he was great. Haliburton was awesome. Police sirens. I wonder if people can hear the police sirens. It's quite a scene walking from the arena to your hotel.
Like,
room, by the way.
I would describe it as somewhere between joyous and euphoric.
It was like it was the kind of scene I've seen when it's 3-1 and your team's on the verge of winning. Like, there was a kid hanging out of a moving car. There was a guy in a Larry Bird Indiana State jersey just running around yelling. Police were high-fiving people. It was great. Anyway, Haliburton was awesome. 22-11-9. If you cared more about his stats, got to chase that 10th rebound, you know? Get
the Tyrese Haliburton, you got to step up.
Get the triple-double,
get 10
man.
Get rebounds and
steal,
step up.
Steal a rebound from somebody. Haliburton was brilliant. Still, even so, stat of the game, Haliburton. In a game they win by 9. Just, and I'm being facetious, but just plus one. And they had been getting destroyed in the non-Haliburton minutes, which are also the non-SGA minutes in the first two games. And they won those minutes decisively tonight. We know why. The bench guys, Mathurin, McConnell, Toppin, big fourth quarter for him. Those guys were plus 16, plus 12, plus 18. Two guys in Toppin and Mathurin that have been the subject of, well, if the Pacers ever need to duck the luxury tax or cut their tax bills, like, they can just dump those guys. Dump those guys. They just won you an NBA Finals game against a 68-win team. There's no dumping. No dumps will be taken with those guys.
Well, the Pacers bench, what was it, 32-24? And they come in. TJ starts doing the TJ thing. They start pressing. He gets a steal. But whatever, goes out of bounds. He does the thing where he goes to the side of the
hulks
corner,
up.
Hulks up in front of everybody. And it was another supercharged thing for the crowd. Because they know, like, they need the energy from those guys. I said to you on Thursday, even though Mathurin was terrible, I said there's something, he looked comfortable to me out there. There was something athletically comfortable for him. And I was thinking today about, just in general, watching the game, they have all these Canadians out there who have all known each other forever. You know, and it's one of the reasons Nembhard, I don't think anyone can really guard SGA, but he's probably looked the best doing it because he's been playing against him since, what, they were 12? He's just not afraid of him. And he knows all his moves. He doesn't fall for his herky-jerky thing. He's just kind of always there. And then, you know, Mathurin isn't afraid of anybody. He's the most irrational, confidence guy you get. And then you flip it on the other side when we're talking about, you know, OKC looking a little young. They don't have that one guy. And again, we're nitpicking. I think that team's great. They don't have that one, like, crazy Mather and Hecheck, let me carry us for 4 minutes guy.
Well, it's the MVP. That's who it is.
Well, but that's the thing. It's SGA and Jalen, but they don't have the random eighth guy that comes off the bench and does whatever. But so I'm trying to think, like, if I'm Indiana, what am I taking away from that game, big picture? Because OKC looked young. We covered that piece. And they know that they can pressure them. They know that they can at least stay in the vicinity of guarding SGA. What are the other big takeaways for you?
I think they can take away, number one, that Haliburton found the right balance in how he needs to play and is growing comfortable more in this series, to the point that, like, I wonder if we see some adjustments from the Thunder defensively on him. I thought Indiana's defense, minus their bigs, are still having issues in the pick and roll against Shea. I thought they amped up the pressure in the second half. They started blitzing him a little bit more and, like, just mixed in different stuff. But minus those kind of breakdowns where Shea would fake toward a screen and go the other way, and Miles Turner would be like, where do you go? Where do you go? And there'd be a layup, or J-Dub, same right. thing. Got him a couple times. Their defense was really good. And actually, one of the reasons I'm interested to go back and watch this game is an insanely low three-point volume game for both teams in 2025. 27 threes for the Pacers, only 22 threes for the Thunder. Like, you don't see games anymore where neither team gets 33. So they were able to limit SGA a little bit, make it tough for him without giving up. Wallace may have had one in the corner that was an awful miss. Like, a lot of their threes were contested, tough threes. Like, it was for a team whose defense is its slight limitation. They've played a pretty good defensive series, like, minus those breakdowns, and just that the bench is ready for, even Ben Shepherd. Those 18 minutes from Ben Shepherd are big, like, competent minutes. Like,
right. Really? Yeah, he was at least staying with SJ. It wasn't like he was shutting him down.
We could not possibly say enough about McConnell and Mathurin. Like, they deserve, like, 10 minutes of this podcast. They were so good.
Well, so when I said to you, I think I said I could see him having 27 in 20 minutes. How many minutes did he play?
Probably 22 more than minutes. 20. And he had 27 points, exactly.
And the only one that I felt like he couldn't really do anything against, because nobody can, is Dort. And he would try to get switches to get away from Dort so he could attack. But it felt like he was comfortable against everybody else. So I wrote down, it was OKC 90-84. Right after that, Jalen Williams hit that big three at the end of the third quarter.
Ooh, that was a killer. Yeah.
And I wrote down, that was an uh-oh for the rest of the decade moment. Because that was one of those, I got it, guys. And, you know, so I wrote down a bunch of stats because there was 3 minutes there. Indy had five turnovers in that quarter. They had seven in the first quarter, none in the second quarter when they played well. Indy was 6-for-22 from three after three quarters. And Turner was 2-for-10 and minus 15. And OKC was plus 9 in rebounds. So every single stat was looking good for OKC. Indy wasn't playing well except for Haliburton and the bench guys when they came in. And then they swung it. And I'm like you, I want to watch that tape again. It felt like the big things that swung were Haliburton made a couple of big plays. SGA looked, what's the word you would use?
I thought...
Frazzled? Wee frazzled?
I just thought their offense, and this is, if the Thunder have, there is no weakness, but if the Thunder have a weakness that we've seen, or a limitation that we've seen in a few of these games, is that their offense can just sort of default into, like, okay, we're just not going to pass. I'm just going to do everything by myself. And J-Dub and Shea both had a lot of those down the stretch, some successful, some not. I think they had 16 assists on, 37 baskets or something?
Yeah.
Today. I mean, that's a somewhat alarming number. And it's telling to me that after every timeout, if you go chart their out-of-timeout plays in this game, almost every one was some kind of, like, really heavily scripted set, like, set piece where SGA would set a back screen for Holmgren, or SGA would set it, like, almost like Warriors-y off-ball stuff. And it's Dagnall trying to be like, let's get some stuff going here. But then when the going gets tough and the game gets into the muck and it's at the end, and the Pacers contested those shots pretty well. Even Nembhard, SGA would shove them off a little bit, and Nembhard would just be like, I got shoved. I'm not going to give up on the play. And they didn't panic. And
yeah, did you notice OKC was doing that? They're doing it to Nesmith too. They were really physical drives.
J-Dub is a tank, man.
I felt like the first quarter and the third quarter, especially, OKC came out with a little bit of a physical swagger. Like, we're a stronger team than this team. Let's punish these guys.
I just wonder if they thought the whole series for Indiana rides on this game. If we can come in here and take this game and go up 2-1 and win two straight in the series, take back home court advantage, we're going to smell blood in the water. They're going to be worried. We're going to reassert our sort of primacy in the series. I wonder if they just came out and like, this is the series for Indiana, because this feels obviously way different if it's OKC 2, Indiana 1. And now it's like, now game 4 is just a perfect, awesome game for us to go to.
Well, and game 4 is also the way they do this final schedule. It's the most interesting game because it's the one game where you only have one day rest.
And by the way, isn't that awesome? Because the 2 days of rest between games 1 and 2, and it's nice they spaced the finals out. You don't want to overstress the players, but it did feel like some of the momentum from that crazy first game was sort of dissipated over 48 hours. Now it's like one day off, practices tomorrow, everyone's going to talk, we go right back at it.
I was probably 10 rows behind the OKC bench, and I was watching them before the game, and I was watching them. They took a big lead the first 4 or 5 minutes. They were up like 13-6.
Was there a double-digit lead in the game at any time? I don't think there was.
I thought, yeah, they got to 15-6. I think that was the biggest lead. And Chet had 8. Haliburton hadn't gotten going in any way yet. And we were actually wondering if he was hurt, because that was a big topic the last day. Is he hiding some sort of injury? He wasn't. He was obviously fine. But in the timeout, they're laughing. All their chests are out. They're like doing... Like, you can kind of tell with benches sometimes how confident a team is. Now I sound like body language guy, but in this case, it's legit.
He made the trip.
And it was really funny to watch that kind of demeanor shift over the course of the game. And by the fourth quarter, there was none of that because they're behind, but it was kind of like almost a little shell shock. Nobody was talking. There was like Caruso coming in and doing like the come on guys. But for the most part, that swagger like got just pulled out of them over the course of 2 hours.
Well, and this was like one of those great finals games where it swung back and forth a bunch of times. It was like, oh, this team's up 4 in momentum. And like immediately the other team would answer. Like both teams had answers and answers and answers until just the Pacers had a few more answers. And then they ran out of clock. OKC missed the free throws they needed to make to have any chance. Caruso didn't get the flagrant call. What did you think of that foul from like your perspective?
I think you get that call in OKC.
I think you get that call in the regular season.
Oh, you 100% get it. If it's a Friday night ESPN game, you get that call.
I didn't mind it not being called. Because
I thought he pulled his hand up right after he hit him. Like he didn't like follow through.
So that's why I mean, I don't want to belabor it because the game, it didn't end up mattering that much. But I do think there's some skill in not being so out of control that you just decapitate someone. And Nesmith, like, he missed his head. He missed his neck. He hit his shoulders and his arms and didn't, like, wind up crazily. Like, he took some precaution to not just kill Alex Caruso in midair.
The problem is he had no chance in that play. He was directly behind him. And usually they give the benefit of the doubt to the guy who's ahead because they don't want those guys to get hurt in those. But I was fine with it.
Can we talk about McConnell and Mathurin more?
So, yeah, we have a bunch of stuff.
McConnell had 3 McConnells in one NBA Finals game.
He caught an inbounds pass.
That's a McConnell. McConnell is an inbound steal. He got 3 of them in one game. I'm like...
Well, so what's an official McConnell? Because he jumped up like a defensive end on the football line. And stole a screen pass,
you know,
basically.
That's actually interesting. Is a McConnell...
It's a full McConnell if he grabs the inbounds pass out of the air.
That's right. A full McConnell is if he's the first person to touch an inbounds pass from the other team and he steals the ball.
Yeah.
A semi-McConnell is they inbound it to another player who catches it and then he just takes the ball away. That's a different... He had 3 full McConnells in one game, including 95-91 in the fourth quarter. Thunder have the ball and they're ahead by 4. Jalen Williams brings the ball over half court, gets pressed a little bit, picks up his dribble inexplicably, and then like throws a pass to nobody. McConnell gets it, goes down the court, misses, offensive rebound, Nembhard hits a short 2, it's 95-93. Instantaneous McConnell put back layup, 95-95. It's
Crowd goes bonkers. What just happened?
Like it could have been a 6-point game and it's tied in 5 seconds and a McConnell?
Crowd goes crazy too. Yeah, there was a few times, like they fucked up a few fast breaks. McConnell had one where he just was like tearing down. It was like a 1-on-4 and he just whipped it into the corner. They reviewed it. It was just a bad play, but where it felt like Indiana was about to go up by 8. And every time it felt that way, they would do something dumb. McConnell was, you know, we've seen him do this at home. Like if you actually watch the Pacers the last couple of years, this is a big part of who they are. It's him coming in these home games and swinging the game. Mathurin, hit or miss, you knew he was going to have a game like this at some point. Toppin was the revelation for me because there's been times in the playoffs where he looks unplayable. And then there's other times in the playoffs where you go, wow, I can't believe the Knicks just gave him away. Because they did. They needed the salary cap, but they literally gave him away. That follow-up dunk he had, which I was lucky because it was on my basket. And you could see there was a miss and you could see him timing it from the foul line and coming up. And all of a sudden he was 12 feet. And by the way, that was one of the big Carlisle moves of the game. He sat Siakam until I think like 3.5 minutes left.
He rode the top and Turner combination. The big man rotation
but
was
sitting Siakam was pretty bold.
Well, it's fitting for the kind of player Pascal Siakam is that the first time we mention him X minutes into this podcast is about how he wasn't in the game for a lot of the fourth quarter. And all he did was finish with 21-6-4 on 8-of-14 shooting. And just like I've said this to you before, he's like the electric current pulsing through the game. You don't notice it all the time, but it's powering them constantly. And like, yes, he was on the bench for some of the fourth quarter. He still had a great game. Defensively, I thought he was awesome. Made a lot of plays on defense.
I think he should have been on the bench for that long. Well, I thought it was really risky because I didn't think Turner was good. And ironically, Turner, in the last couple of minutes, had 3 straight awesome defensive plays that kind of clinched the game. So that's why he was out there. But he was bad for most of the game.
Well, Toppin, you know, he has... It's 105-100. I'm not doing this from straight memory, but I just looked at the play-by-play. 105-100. Dort misses a wide-open corner 3 to bring it to within 2.
By the way, I thought that was going in.
I didn't. I mean, anything Lou Dort touched for the Dort first 3 quarters of the game was going in.
Dort hit the point where I think every shot he's taking is going in.
Toppin got what will go as an unheralded, really good contested defensive rebound.
Yep.
So defensive rebound by Toppin, immediate offensive put back dunk by Toppin on a Haliburton miss. And then Toppin switches onto J-Dub on the next possession and blocks him at the rim.
Yeah.
3 incredible Toppin plays in 45 seconds to swing the game from like really in the balance of that door 3 goes in or they get an offensive rebound or something to Indiana is now in full control of the game going down the stretch.
He's a classic nice guy to have in a playoff home game with an awesome crowd.
I mean, that putback dunk was...
You know who's like that for the Celts? Robert Williams was like that. There's certain guys who are just like great playoff home game guys.
I actually thought about Robert Williams today for some reason during a meeting I had with somebody. And I was talking about a center. I was thinking about centers that can rim run and pass and how rare that combination is and how it looked like Robert, Time Lord was going to be one of those guys. I mean, and now it's like... Where is he? What's happening? Anyway.
I allowed myself to think of the Celtics today as I was walking to the whatever the Indiana Arena is called, which, by the way, has been around since
Fieldhouse.
1999?
Yeah. It might be my favorite arena in the NBA.
Same year as Staples Center? The place is awesome. Yeah. And the Staples Center should be fumigated. But I was thinking as I was walking there a year ago, I went to the 2 Dallas Celtic games in Dallas, which were super fun. And it was like, really felt like the Celtics were going to win the title. And this was, hopefully this finals could be, and now the Celtics era is completely over. Everybody's being traded.
Wasn't game 3 the seminal Luka whines at the refs and fouls out?
That was the Jaylen Brown Duncan traffic game. Yeah. That was the Jaylen Brown won the finals MVP that game.
That was a crazy game to be at.
And that was the, Luka just fouled out. Oh my God, this is full circle Kyrie. Kyrie is going to beat the Celtics in this game. Right. I can't believe this is lined up. And then he actually missed some shots. We're going to take a break and a lot more to discuss about this game. This episode is brought to you by Uber Eats. Summer is here and you can now get almost anything you need for your sunny days delivered with Uber Eats. What do I mean by almost? Well, you can't get a well-groomed lawn delivered, but you can get chicken parmesan delivered. I love chicken parm. A day in the sun? No. A bottle of rum? Yes. Uber Eats can definitely get you that. Get almost anything delivered with Uber Eats. Order now. For alcohol, you must be legal drinking age. Please enjoy responsibly. Product availability varies by region. See app for details. let's talk about Indiana, the basketball city, because we're both here, which is a really special place. And obviously, I've talked about it a million times. It's the place of Hoosiers and Larry Bird. And, you know, it's 49 states. And then there's Indiana, whatever the saying is. They show Oscar Robertson, courtside, you know, legend in high school in the 1950s. It's weird. Oscar doesn't really have a team in the NBA because he played for the Cincinnati Royals that don't exist anymore. And then he was in the Bucks for a few years. But Indiana is kind of weirdly his team. Then they go back. They show Reggie Miller. They show Edgerrin James.
That was a great one.
I was like, this is great. Please show Larry Legend. Where is he? Yeah. But the crowd was just, you know, everyone's wearing jerseys. Everyone is like super optimistic. And a bunch of people were talking to me or yelling at me, like, but what do you think? What do you think? We got a chance. Like, just like the happiest basketball place. So much fun to come here. And you made the key point. The arena is probably the best.
It's a great arena.
Every I think it's number one for me.
Every seat is good.
Even the corners are good. The crowd feels like they're on top of the game. When you have a game like today, I do think it affects the game. Because I think if you're the visiting team, it's just, it feels like the fans are on top of you in a slightly different way. And those fans are fantastic.
And boy, game four. I mean, look, Oklahoma City's had gut check moments in the Denver series down 2-1. That was a big test. Minnesota, I mean, up 2-1 in Minnesota for game four. Semi gut check. A little bit of a gut check. This is the ultimate, if you want to become a championship team, this is about as big of a game and as big of a test as you're going to face. Down 2-1 in the finals on the road against a team that has proven itself championship caliber and that absolutely thinks we can do the whole thing. Like, there's no doubt. If there were any doubt, and I don't really think there was, there is no doubt anymore that, like, we can do the whole thing.
So the 2015 Warriors, I think they
did the whole thing.
Well, I think they fell behind 2-1 to Memphis.
They did.
And hit that similar point, and they had to win game four in Memphis.
In the second round, it wasn't like...
No, this is way bigger stakes. But it was the same kind of... With the younger teams, you have the chest hair game. I thought they already had the chest hair game when the Denver series. You know,
they had three of them.
Well, yeah. The
four of them, if you include a game six loss.
Was it game four? All these games blend together. One of those. Game four or game five?
Game four and game five, they both won. Game four
in Denver.
Game four in Denver in a game where
in game five
they were behind and teetering, and then Wiggins, that was the Wiggins, right, Wallace, right, making shots against the zone,
and Jalen Williams game. Hit the three in game. Yeah, it was that stretch. I thought that's when they got through it, but now you're right. This is because I watched this happen. The reason I mentioned that Dallas Miami series at the top, you can think you're the better team, and OKC has a better team. They have a better team, but you still have to beat the other team four times. Indiana doesn't think OKC is better than them. They showed it today. And at some point, they're going to have to go and take it. And when you're at these games, when you're in the room and you feel it slipping away, there's no other sport like it. Like football, baseball, none of these other sports have where you're watching it going, I can't believe this is how it's playing out. I remember in the Dallas-Miami series, Jason Terry hit that crazy 30-foot three against Miami to clinch, I think it was game five. Hit the hand LeBron's hand in his face.
Yeah.
Even when he was taking it, I was like, I can't believe Dallas is going to win game five. This is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And then they won it. They win in six. So there's going to be a moment in game four when OKC is going to have to decide, is this really how our season's going to end? This is what's going to happen?
First of all, just for the record, the Cavs were up 2-1 over the Warriors in the 2015 finals. So the Warriors did have a game four on the road, and that's when they went small and
started to go small. Did you ever think that Cavs without Kyrie and...
Starting Mozgov and Iman Shumpert.
I never felt the Warriors, like the Warriors
with
were in...
Brian Windhorst.
Yeah, I never felt like the Warriors were in like major danger. It was weird. Memphis, I felt like was more dangerous for them because Memphis was so weird.
So here's the thing about like, you just said Oklahoma City is a better team. I think we all think Oklahoma City's a better team.
Doesn't mean they're going to win the series.
No, but, and I can hear Indiana fans saying, oh, hold on now. Like, you erase our first 30 games when Halliburton is just finding his rhythm after a tough start, and we get our defense together, Nembhard and Nesmith get healthy and back in the lineup. We can go toe-to-toe with anybody. And they were much better. I'm just looking up the numbers now. From February 1st till end of season. So half the season, basically. Oklahoma City, 31-5, net rating 13.7. Indiana, 24-12, net rating 3.7. So getting there, but like still kind of a big gap. From March 1st on, it gets narrower. Oklahoma City, 20-3, plus 12.9. Indiana, 17-7, plus 5.3. So yeah, the gap narrowed, but like this is still surprising that Indiana has gotten this good this fast and kept trending up and kept narrowing that gap. And now they're just as good. I mean, we didn't talk enough about Mathurin, your guy.
So he's the one guy in the team who feels like he can create his own shot against really good defense, no matter who's guarding him, except for Lu Dort, who's the Grim Reaper.
What was impressive to me was how calm he looked. Just how easy those mid-range jumpers look for him. Like, yeah. I'm just walking right into him, just strolling into it. And maybe you got to pressure him more or whatever. There was a lot of commentary on Twitter about, you know, Oklahoma City's bigs are too far back on somebody. You know, I thought it was mostly good defense. Like, you just got to make guys make shots. But he scored on jumpers. He scored on pull-up threes. He scored on catch-and-shoot threes. He had a bunch of cuts in the first half, off and off of McConnell actions and stuff, where it's like he just had a very mature all-around floor game that you don't necessarily associate with a guy that was kind of known as a chucker. And he did a little bit of everything. He got transition points. Like, a little bit of every part of his offensive game came out, and he
had 14 in the second quarter.
Yeah, and he's like, you know, there's this whole thing of Indiana never tanks and they build from the middle, and that's largely true. He is the product of, like, they're really only close to bottoming out season when they got the sixth pick, and Jairus Walker is the other one, and he's not playing. He's been injured and whatever, but like, they're now getting something from him. They're getting a lot from him. They're just they just have a lot of really good players, man.
I actually think Walker would have played in this series.
I do too.
Yeah, I like Walker. 14 in the second quarter for him. It's a weird one because it feels like he's been on the trade block for about a year in some ways. Like, he has felt available, and he's always the person that gets brought up first. You said that earlier when they talk about if they change the team, is he in it? If they try to upgrade, like if they try to get like Cam Johnson or whoever. But I don't know. I like the vibe that he brings to them, this hit or miss. He can carry you for a quarter. Like, I really value guys like that.
So there's this whole
debate. Peyton Pritchard was like that for the Celtics, where he could just carry them for 8 minutes out of nowhere. And you never knew when it was going to happen. And when it happened, it was like a fucking, you felt like you found money in your pocket.
There's this whole debate with Mathurin about, you know, he doesn't really play the Pacer style. Like, the ball sticks with him a little bit more. Right. He's not as intuitive, a quick twitch, quick pass, quick cut decision maker as everybody else on the team. And I think I said this to you last time we podcasted, like, initially, I think that was thought of as like, he's not that great of a fit. He doesn't play the way we feel. And the more I watch him, the more I'm like, every team kind of needs a curveball. That's like, even the Warriors, like Steve Kerr, like it's a little bit of a weird example to bring up now, but he would always be like, the reason I like Wiggins on our team is he can break away from our beautiful game cuts and just like get us a few buckets one-on-one when nothing else is working. We need that kind of guy on our team. I think he's like the curveball that to be a championship team, you kind of need. If you play a style that's like Indiana, I think you need a guy who can be like, that style's cool, but I'm just going to do some like traditional guy stuff.
Right.
Be the guy.
I don't feel like he's as ball stoppy as he used to be.
No, he's gotten much better. And defensively, he's gotten better too.
One thing I noticed, I wanted to talk to you because it's about as basketball nerdy as I'm going to get with you. You can go 7 levels higher than me with some of the super nerd stuff and talk pin downs and double pin downs and reverse pin downs.
Oh, yeah.
And upside down pin downs. How many pin downs are there?
I had a lot of pin downs. A lot of the Pacers are breaking out some whole pin
down
stuff.
You can do a full pin down podcast. One thing I've noticed that these two teams specifically do, and I don't know if it's a trend, and I don't know if it's something teams will copy when they watch this and see what's successful. They do it with Shea, with OKC, and they do it with Haliburton, but then weirdly also with Mathurin, where it's like the guy has the ball, set him a pick up top, he's moving around, he's moving back, he dumps it off, the ball immediately comes back to him, and it's like this constant he had, it's almost like watching a hockey power play where they keep giving it back to the defenseman so he can reset whatever the attack on the net. And the ball just kind of keeps moving around in these little hockey passes versus like how the Celtics play, where it's like, we dribble up. I'm going to hunt this matchup. Come set me a pick. You three guys stand there. I'm just going to keep dribbling until I get the look I want. And then I'm going to shoot. Indy's doing a version of that in OKC is too, where the ball is still moving around all the time, but they're doing the same thing. And I think it's way harder to stop. And I wonder if it's going to be something that's replicated next season. Is that, was that coherent? Do you know what I mean?
Somewhat coherent. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's 12:20
a.m. Yeah, I'm a little groggy.
You flew cross country.
I did.
You know, it's, you're doing great. I mean, Indiana definitely plays a more random, unpredictable style than Oklahoma City. And I just think,
but do you think that they deliberately don't want anybody to have the ball for more than like three and a half seconds?
For sure.
It seems that's a real thing for them.
It's can't be a hard and fast rule because sometimes Siakam has a mismatch. You just got to give him the ball and let him manufacture some points in the first quarter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he'll back down. That's like the one time they'll mess around with it.
And Mathurin, you know, will do his stuff. But I mean, it's, you can only play that way if your best player, your offensive number one option, is a guy who wants to get off the ball fast, who lives to get other people involved. And often, you know, Anthony Edwards is learning this in Minnesota. Like, if you get off the ball, you will often get it back. It will go all the way around to you because you will have compromised the defense with that first pass, and it will, they'll be in rotation, and you'll be the guy who the ball should get back to in rotation. And Haliburton just plays that way. You can't play that way if your best player doesn't have that kind of basketball ethos to him, and he does.
Yeah, because in person, you can watch. It's much easier to watch the people who don't have the ball. So I was watching some of the stuff Nesmith was doing in the second half as they're doing all the stuff on the top, and Haliburton is dipping off. He's getting back and they're moving around. And they're trying to create mismatches and he's in the corner. But then sometimes he would kind of creep in if the defender was falling asleep on him and see if he could get a little back cut, or he would dart in, or he would try to get an offensive rebound. Everybody in that team is up to something. It's not a team where the guys are just like, I'll just be here in the corner. I hope it works out for you. You know what I mean?
So they are very, I've talked about this on my nerdier podcast before.
On the pin down?
But on the pin down with Zach Lowe.
That would have been a good title.
But we're going to get deep now, deep in Indiana Pacers lore right now. They are extremely proud of Nesmith for exactly what you just described, for learning how to move without the ball, to screen, to be random, to cut, to always be on his toes.
Well, remember, on the Celtics, he just stood there.
Well,
that was one of the reasons. I mean, wasn't his fault. And they just told him, go in the corner. You're not going to have the ball.
And you know what the deep cut is? The guy they give a lot of credit, not only for that, but for his partnership with Haliburton, and Haliburton really leaning into a crazy motion, get off the ball offense, is a guy who's no longer on the Pacers. It's Buddy Hield. The coaches of the Pacers talk about Buddy Hield's lasting impact on Nesmith, on Haliburton, and just how they play. Like, it comes up, and everybody loves Buddy Hield. He's the most gregarious personality. He's an extremely hard worker. He's a beloved teammate. Everybody loves Buddy Hield, but they talk about his impact in particular on exactly what you just described with Nesmith more than anyone else on the team.
I wonder if it's replicable. Or I wonder if they just have been doing it for so long. Because OKC they have their version of it, but then they also do what you talked about earlier, where it's just a lot of dribbling and the ball stops moving around in the same way.
And look, they made tough shots. Like if you said before the game, Chet, J-Dub, and Shea are going to combine for 70 points on like not great shooting, but let me see if I can do the math. 24 of 53. With a lot of free throws between them too. Like, it's not like their offensive rating for the game is bad, but it didn't feel like, I mean, they got nothing from the bench. Hartenstein's first bad game of the series. Wiggins disappeared, got zero.
The Hartenstein thing is an issue. That'll be one of the topics tomorrow about maybe this is why they were so afraid to play the double bigs. Maybe they anticipated this. Maybe there was stuff during the season that they saw with this matchup with him. I thought he looked a little gamey. I'm also like, if I'm Indiana, I'm delighted when, and I think Isaiah Joe's a good player, but every time somebody like Isaiah Joe or even Wiggins is in the game, I'm so happy that the fucking gauntlet of all those defenders aren't out there at the same time. And conversely, I mean, watching what Nembhard was trying to do to SGA, and I thought that he got called for a couple chintzy fouls. Watching how different SGA was the moment Nembhard would come out of the game versus when Nembhard in, I thought was pretty interesting. It was like the straight jacket came off, basically.
Nembhard is just awesome.
Like pick 31.
Pick 31.
We're just never going to be good at the draft. That's what we learn over and over again. Pick 31. 30 pick, guys over him.
Pick 31, and they got him and the pick that became Ben Shepherd in the same little just random trade. I think it was one of the Caris LeVert trades. And Nembhard, 8 points, nothing jumps off the stat sheet. He's just an awesome basketball player. Like, I remember when he signed that contract, which was like $18, $19 million a year. If you go back and read some of the reviews, like, I don't know, that's like a little too much for a team that's going to be up against the tax. I remember just thinking, like, the guy's good.
Yeah.
Like, a good player making $20 million, that's just fine. Like, he's just a really good player. Are you ever unhappy when Andrew Nembhard is on the floor, no matter what he's doing? It's like, I'm always happy to have that guy around. Even if he's floating around on offense or not guarding the best guy, or he's switched on to that guy, it's like, he's going to do the right thing every single time, even if the right thing is not something that you really notice.
He's also a dick. And I mean this as a compliment. He's got a dick side that's like very, very underground, but it'll come out once or twice a game. There's a moment in the game where SGA got fouled, and then was going for a continuation. Nembhard came in and basically did the second foul on him. And SGA didn't like it. He went to the ref to complain about the foul. And Nembhard just walked over right next to him and was just like being a dick. And was like, really, you're going to bitch about that? And was just kind of just trying to get under his skin a little bit, which he's been doing in every series. And he loves it. And it's like a Canadian thing. He's doing like the Canadian playoff hockey thing. He's like the guys, basically he would be on Florida, just like hit somebody with his stick right after the whistle.
I did listen to you and Ryan talk about the Stanley Cup Finals a little bit. It made me want to get into the Stanley Cup Finals.
Like, you would love it.
Florida apparently has got a lot of hateable guys. The Florida
Nembhard
Panthers
wouldn't even crack the top five for.
What's the score? Who's winning that, sir? They play.
Florida's up.
Do they alternate so at least we can go NBA Finals, NHL Finals?
Yeah, they
Finals?
Do. They okay. try to steer okay. clear from NBA. Yeah, no, that game three was the classic where Florida took a big lead and then we just had to have fights. Each team has to lay down their masculinity on the other team.
I will never get over that fighting is just allowed in hockey. It's
crazy. The one that's really crazy is there's professional lacrosse stuff where they can fight. In hockey, you have skates. Like, you only can get so much leverage. If you're in lacrosse, you can really, like, you know, plant and sock somebody. I'm kind of surprised at lacrosse fights. All right, more stuff from this game.
Yeah, go.
OKC starting five with Wallace. Do we see anything different in game four, which I think we both agree is a backs to the wall game for OKC? Because if you go down 3-1 with game six looming, I don't care how good you are, that's a place that only a few teams in the history of the league has come back from.
I think the only move, I'm going to guess no. I think the only reasonable move, unless it's something out of left field, like we're going to just start Kenrich Williams and see what happens in the Cason Wallace spot. I think the only move is to start Caruso over Wallace.
That's what I had as well.
And I don't really know that anything that happened today screams for that being necessary, but.
Well, Caruso, I don't love the plus Caruso, minus stat, but did you see the plus minus stat?
Caruso, Caruso was minus 15 today, and Wallace was minus 10. So take whichever you like. But I mean, Caruso played 32 minutes, and I don't know how much more than that he's going to play, even if you start him or not. But he is better than Cason Wallace. And
I do wonder, like, we see these coaches, the further you get in the playoffs, that rotation starts to tighten, right? And OKC is an unusual team because, like, even today, they played 11 minutes, like, legitimately. I mean, 11 guys played. Kenrich Williams only played 2 minutes, but they still, played 11 minutes.
And I hated the one
minutes.
Shot Kenrich Williams took. Do you remember the shot that he took?
It wasn't great.
He just got the ball at the three-point arc, jab step, like 28 feet from the rim. Like, I guess I'm just going to shoot now. It's like one of those possessions where it's like, hey.
I'm in the finals. I'm going to take a three. I just feel like you're probably good with 9 guys, maybe 10 max. But if you're down, usually what we see team short in the rotation, go to 8, maybe 7, playing big minutes. I had the same thought. I wonder if Caruso just starts and maybe they do it that way. The only other one I was thinking was, would they start Isaiah Joe for some just a weird 3-point look out of nowhere for 7 minutes?
That's another out of left field one. I don't see it. The other thing that's interesting is, in the last two games, we've seen zero of the no big man lineup. And I thought that lineup did not, I think the plus minus was not good in game one, but I still thought it was something I would try if I were the Thunder. And I'm a little surprised that they've gone like completely away from it. I would like to see that as like a 4-minute just blitz them with switching and swiping and steals and see if that can just like muck up the game a little bit with even more speed than we normally have.
Well, neither of us work for ESPN anymore, but I think we have
to. I don't?
We have to do a
segment. What happened?
No, we're both gone. We have to do a segment called Step Up.
Okay.
Who's got to step up? I'm looking at the box score right now, and Kaysan Wallace, I don't know if you need to step up. Isaiah Hartenstein, you need to step up. Miles Turner maybe needs to step up.
Isaiah Hartenstein, the $30 million man.
Yeah. You were their big free agent addition?
Yeah, 4-3.
No, that's the thing is, like, I think that was just a really nice, competitive fucking basketball
maybe
game.
Maybe SGA? Slight step up?
Well, let's talk about
10%
that.
10% step up?
24 points, 6 turnovers, 4 assists.
20 shots, 24 points, 42 minutes.
It took us too long to get here.
Yeah.
He did not play a good enough game.
He didn't.
Took us too long to get to SGA. We're so in love with the McConnells and the Mathurins and the Toppins. Took us too long to get to SGA. Because he didn't play. He was like good. Or like it's a B- SGA game probably.
I would go C+.
C plus.
So here was the vibe I got from him in this game. It reminded me of FIBA. As you know, I'm one of the only people that loves all the FIBA games and the Olympics. When the rules are different and we send the guys over there and they think they're going to get a call and they don't get it. And then they do another and they don't get the call and they're just kind of...
Are you going free throw merchant? Is that where you're going with this?
I'm not going merchant. It just felt like he was getting defended in a way that he didn't really adjust to as well. He was trying to bounce off guys. There was one time where, you know, he did get the hook arm. He did that a couple times. But for the most part, I thought the refs called him really fairly. I thought they called both sides. Like, the Indiana crowd was probably madder than maybe they should have been. But, you know, they're a home crowd. They're doing. But I thought for the most part, they allowed a lot of physicality on both sides. And I don't know if that's great for him.
I also thought, again, like, with the exception of their big man point of attack defense on some pick and rolls, like Miles Turner, Thomas Bryant. Thought their defense was pretty good, and I thought their off-ball defense, I'll go back and watch it tomorrow, but just like they're stunting back and forth on his pick and rolls, they're trying to make him a decision maker and cloud his decision making, and I thought they did a good job of that tonight. Like, a few of his turnovers were bad pass turnovers on the pick and roll where he was kind of caught in between reads a little bit and didn't quite know what to do with it. I thought their defense, and they started doubling him. He loves to do the thing where he drives to like the deadest dead spot on the floor, the spot that nobody ever wants the ball in, which is like 18 feet from the rim on the baseline, because he just thinks no one is going to come help here. It's just going to be me, because who's going to double here? And the Pacers, as the Wolves did a little bit in the last series, started springing doubles on him there.
So Toppin kept coming over. I thought that was smart.
We're just not going to give you this shot. We're going to force you to pass it. And once they gave up their rotations were bad. Isaiah Joe hit a wide open three, like the one guy you absolutely cannot leave open on Oklahoma City. But other than that, their rotations were pretty good. And, you know, I just think, you know, again, Rick Carlisle was very good at not overdoing anything. Like, just because they did that a few times today and it worked, they may not do it the first couple times Shea goes to that spot in game four.
They did a nice job. It didn't feel like he was going downhill as much as he normally does in playoff games when he's just scoring 36 to 38 points. My guess would be he's going to be awesome in game four.
I mean, game two was just a spectacular.
Yeah, that was an A+. Today was a C+.
Yeah. And when
maybe they stumbled on something.
I was an easy teacher, so I'd give him a B-. But when the MVP has a B-, C+, like, you're vulnerable.
My grades for today, the Indiana crowd was an A+. A plus. Okay. Superb job by them. I have no notes. Just keep doing what you're doing, Indiana. And I loved having Oscar Robertson and Reggie Miller there. And Larry Legend should be here for game four if they really want to bring the roof down. Fucking private
Mark
jet.
Mark Jackson was here.
Mark Jackson was there?
Mark Jackson was up in a suite.
Yeah. I thought Halliburton was probably an A.
Yeah.
I think he was the A plus would have been the game four Knicks series. I really liked some of the stuff he was doing on defense. I thought he was active and problematic for OKC, but I thought he was fantastic. Toppin gets an A minus for me. Mathurin gets an A. TJ McConnell, probably a B plus. I didn't like a couple of the turnovers.
Okay.
And then for OKC, I really liked what Jalen Williams did in that game. I thought they relied on him in kind of a shocking way offensively, where it almost felt like they were 1A, 1B, a little Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum-ish.
It does feel like the more stress they get put under and the fewer easy transition baskets they get, when that's when they get rolling, right? Like, and that's when their passing gets unleashed and they get alley-oops and all that. It does feel like, for not all the time, not even for the majority of the time, but for segments of each of these games, high-pressure games, that there's not as much synergy between Shea and J-Dub as you would like there to be.
From little dueling banjos?
A little bit of like they'll be, wow, there's been a lot of Jalen Williams going on right now, and Shea's kind of standing in the corner, like, okay, now there's a lot of Shea going on. And you would just like a little bit more possessions when there's like a lot of both going on. That's all.
We're going to take a break, and then I have a really important subject to bring up about this series that's I could see getting cut out in a social media video.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. All right, coming back. Social media segment time.
Okay.
You want to say it? I'll let you do it.
Kyle, turn the TikTok camera on.
If OKC loses this series.
Oh, boy, here we go. You can't resist going to the end. We're in the middle. Let's enjoy the middle.
I wasn't allowing myself or even considering it was a possibility until I was in that arena tonight, when realizing that OKC has to figure out how to win in that arena either Friday night or next week.
Yep.
Or they're not going to win the title.
It's good math. Your math is right.
If they don't win the title, this would be an absolute historic basketball calamity, because they had one of the greatest seasons of all time. And start to finish. I'm not saying they're one of the greatest teams of all time, but they had one of the 7, 8, 9, 10, whatever list you want to do, from net ratings to actual record to dominance to 15, 20 point wins. It was one of the best seasons anyone's ever had. And to then go to the finals and lose, you're in rare ground. You're in 2016 Warriors, Draymond punching LeBron in the balls and Steph playing on an injured ankle and Festus Ezeli being trapped on an island against LeBron for two straight threes. And all of a sudden we've lost. What the hell happened? This does not happen a lot in basketball. Usually the right team, usually the better team, usually the team that has the best season wins the title. But then occasionally that's not what happens. And this is one of those times.
It would be interesting to look back at most dominant teams that didn't win.
It's the shortest list possible.
I remember doing this last year when Boston was on the verge of winning the title. Because of their, what did they win, 66 games last year or something? Like,
yeah, that. when you get into the 80 win territory as a team, when you're 80-18, 82-20, like.
But I remember going through Basketball Reference and doing the wins, regular season wins, regular season net rating, playoff net rating, and how many teams checked every box at a certain level of eliteness or whatever. Yeah. And like just narrowing it down or finagling the numbers in different ways. And let's just say when the Thunder were up 2-0 against Minnesota, I reread the piece that I ended up writing about Boston and where that Boston team's place in history should be and would be compared to those other teams.
Which was a pure math case.
And just, well, no, just like, and but it wasn't a pure math case.
No, just like record, but, stats.
The ultimate conclusion, which I think was right, and a lot of people made it, was the math says that Celtics team is like way up here. I think they're probably a little bit, like, really great team, but with some of the other just like really great teams, not as up here as the massive. But anyway, I just cut and pasted that and put it in an email to myself to have it fresh in preparation for what looked like, I mean, when they were up 2-0 against Minnesota, it was like, are they just going to win? Are they not losing for the rest of the season?
Like, I think I led my podcast that night that way. Like, did they arrive?
Were. Yeah. Well, I mean, are they just going to go 6-0 and the playoffs are going to be over before we know it? And now, and again, like, the net rating can be what it is. Like, and again, the Pacers became a very good team. The signs were all there, but there was still a difference between what Oklahoma City was resume wise and what the Pacers were last 40 games, even resume wise. Calamity, I mean, I just think you have to give the credit to the Pacers. Something magical has happened here, and they're still a long way from finishing it off. Like, this is going to be very hard to do against a great team that's still probably favored. I would like to look
up the
odds.
That's a good segment. Magical or calamity? Magical? Calamity.
Calamical?
I think you're right in that the story leans more toward this is one of the most incredible stories in the history of the NBA. That something this Pacers happened. Team won the title.
Something happened here.
But I also think another piece would be, holy shit, OKC checked every box we ever thought we'd have to check for a team that was going to win the title, and they didn't win the
Except
title.
Except for one box that you've already brought
Youth.
Up. Age. Yeah. Veteran, whatever.
Well, that's the scariest thing with them is that if they end up winning the title, I don't feel like they're close to being the team they're probably going to be 2 years from now if everyone's healthy. They're just going to be better.
They're going to be better. And like the poster guy for that to me is Chet.
Right.
I was talking to Drew Hanlon before the game. He works with Chet among many other people. And I was just saying to him, like, I watch Chet in these games and he's missed so much time in his brief NBA career. And he'll do 3 or 4 things every game where I'm like, is he just kind of scratching the surface of what he's going to do offensively? Like, is he even doing 50% of what he's going to be able to do offensively? Drew's response was enthusiastic. Yes, like, there's a lot more there, and I won't go into the conversation anymore, but he's the guy.
So you're saying Drew Hanlon talked about one of the players he was training?
Well, I talked about it, and he, like, nodded.
I'm kidding. Well, I think he's right, because it's funny. Van texted me a couple of days ago and was like, how good is Chet? I'm like, what do you mean? It's like, is there more here, or is this it? And I was like, I actually think there's way more
way
here.
More.
Because even in college, the way they used him at Gonzaga, he'd be at the top of the key and he would almost like a little like how Duke used Cooper Flagg last year, where he was a little point forwardy sometimes. But I think there's this whole other level where you could run offense through him at the top of the key and he could either fake threes or go, you know, kick out. There's a post-up game that he'll probably have, 4 years from now?
I mean, in the first quarter of that game, he had a coast-to-coast take around Miles Turner. Yeah. And then he had a little short roll where Miles Turner was there, like on the catch. And he just took like one dribble, pivot, step back, like 12-footer or 15-footer. It's like, God damn, that's a tough shot.
This seems pretty amazing.
They're down 2-1 in the finals to the Indiana Pacers.
I'm going to go on FanDuel right now. What do you think the line is?
Oklahoma City -110. But I have no, to be clear to the listeners, I have no idea how any of this works.
OKC -235.
That's, wow. Wow.
That's a thing.
Wasn't it -350 or something coming into this game? So this win, I guess it's a home win.
It jumped up to the 500s again after they won game two. Everyone and their brother had OKC in 5 as their finals pick. Did you have it? I had it.
We're wrong. We're officially wrong 3 games into the series.
Everyone was wrong. And I didn't want to do it because everyone had it. I wanted to zag, and I just couldn't figure out how Indiana was going to win 2 games. And now we know that game one game, that comeback and Halliburton and the shot he hits, and that's how you could that be how the entire series swings? I don't know. All right, predictions for game 4. And then I have some trade stuff to ask you about.
Oh, good. I like a 12:45.
Yeah,
just
super groggy.
Let's go.
Well, you had one thing on your pod I really want to dive into.
Okay, predictions for game 4. I'm just going to say Oklahoma City wins a very close game. But Oklahoma City 118, Indiana 114.
Well, can we talk what maybe neither team, because they're both pretty young, who has an advantage from that game today that we just went to was like a playoff game and a half.
Yeah.
Incredibly physical, up and down. intense, emotional, and now they got to play on Friday. And I can't decide who that's more of a detriment to. My guess is the home crowd probably helps Indiana more. OKC, I have my eye on Chet because I really thought he looked wiped out in the fourth quarter. He was the one out of all the OKC guys that I thought looked like he was spent. SGA, maybe, I don't know, but maybe that's, but on the other side, Haliburton, I don't know. My guess is it's going to be kind of an ugly, dramatic game and it'll be decided by somebody weird.
I like it.
I'm going
Oklahoma City by four.
I would pick OKC as well. OKC is favored by six. I would not do that.
That's a lot. It's a lot of points. That's like, but I bet for Thunder, even Thunder playoff games, that's not very many points.
I love this series and I don't care what the ratings are. And if casual fans don't care because famous people that they knew or famous franchises aren't in it, you know what? Why do we need them? The NBA just signed an 11-year media deal. I'm fine. I love basketball. That game was awesome. I like that we have two new teams that are now in the fray. And I think this finals is a win. And guess what? Indiana's a really small city. And so is Oklahoma City. Shit happens.
Well, the MVP is in the series, right? That should be a very famous player. You and Ryan talked about how he's maybe not one of the 10 most famous players
in the NBA. It's a little Mike Troutish.
Okay. But he is the MVP. And no matter who the teams are, if it's a long series, the ratings will go up as the series goes on. So I'll speak a.
Well, what was the last great finals?
Great.
The last great finals. 2013.
No, 2016 has to be the baseline. Oh, 2016. Everything after that is Warriors, Raptors, bubble. Bucks Suns was a great finals. It was just weird because the crowd, weren't we still in like half filled?
Yeah, it was a little like half COVID.
That's an underrated finals. That was a really good finals.
Yeah, that's a good call. All right, so Bucks Suns, 16 Warriors Cavs, 13 Spurs Heat, I think is the best finals of the last 15 years.
Those two back to back. They're almost like Rocky 1 and Rocky 2. Like they should all be one movie.
But Miami broke in the second finals, though.
Yeah, but that's part of why it's like all one movie.
And then 11 finals, Mavs versus Heat.
Great one.
Tremendous. 2010 Lakers Celtics, dramatic, but the basketball, I don't think was that great.
Ugly.
I'm trying to think what else. Yeah, I think those are probably the best ones of the century. 05 Pistons Spurs, the game 7 was kind of a dud for a game 7.
Ugly and ratings were nobody wanted.
You know what was a good one was the 2000 Pacers Lakers series. That's a really fun series if you go back and look through those games.
That's a great Kobe game, game 4 when Shaq fouls out.
All right, quickly. So you were talking about Durant and you said watch out for the Clippers, which I had kind of heard rumblings of myself. And I think Durant's going to the Spurs. I'm just going to slap it down a second time. I think that's how it plays out.
For sure, the two teams that there's the most buzz about are the Spurs and the Wolves.
Right. So the Wolves gets more complicated because...
Wolves one just breaks my brain. I don't know how it's going
to
work.
Julius Randle and Naz Reid have to be involved somehow?
You can do a Gobert one. You can do Gobert plus DiVincenzo one.
Why do the Suns want Gobert?
I mean, Booker Gobert is something. Something. If you want to stay competitive because you don't have any control of your draft picks because you've ishbied all of them away.
Would you take Vassell, 14, Harrison Barnes expiring, and a good first?
Yes.
For Durant?
I would. I don't even think this... I don't know how... The biggest mystery in the league right now is how aggressive the Spurs are actually going to get. And I think that's code for they're going to start with no number two, no Castle, no Vassell, and negotiate from there, I think. That's what I would guess that they're going to do. Like, two and Castle are just out.
KD's 37, and he makes 50 a year, and he's got 1 year left on his deal, and he's been in the league for 18 years.
There's the subplot I forgot to get into on my podcast. The two-year, $112 million extension he could sign with
AKA the Jimmy Butler? Do you do the one extra or the two extra?
Do the Suns... Is there a team that will trade for him, not caring whether he signs it or not, not even wanting him to sign it, maybe? B, Well, the Suns just, the Suns, I assume, and I'm thinking, we'll just trade him wherever. Like, if this team's not on your list, too bad. We're trading you to whoever gives us the best package. There's no list anymore.
I think after how they handled February, it seems like they're working with Rich Klein and KD's guy. It seems like they're being cooperative, because the way they handled it in February was not the way things usually go in the NBA.
What if the Toronto Raptors are just like, you know what, we're going to try for a Kawhi 2.0 moonshot. Here's the best package you're going to get. KD doesn't want to go there. We don't even care if you sign the extension.
You know who I don't want to deal with is a semi or unhappy Kevin Durant.
Yeah.
I'm just not messing with that.
So, but like what?
He should go to the Spurs. That's how it's going to play out.
Is he going to be happy with the Spurs just because he decides he wants to go there?
Here's the case for the Spurs. He went to the University of Texas. He loves Texas. He talks about it all the time. He's always respected the Spurs. He'll be like the respected veteran on the team. People in Texas like him. Like, the only two places he's ever really fit in a way where he loved the city was Texas and Seattle.
He picked the Nets.
He picked the team that was like the black sheep of the New York basketball scene.
And he picked the Suns.
Yeah.
And he was 0-2 in happiness levels. And he was unhappy in Golden State at the end, too. I mean,
he was unhappy the last year and a half of Golden State.
Yeah. So
I think he would be happy on the Spurs.
I hope so. I mean, Kevin Durant is an awesome, awesome basketball player. I love everything.
If you're the Spurs and you can keep enough stuff left to also make a Giannis run, you're doing it. And by
the way, whoa.
Yeah. Whoa, what?
Can they, is that even like?
Sure.
They've given away, they gave some of their picks away, including the Minnesota pick in the Fox deal. De'Aaron Fox is like we barely got to see it, right?
I didn't forget, because it's weird because they end up with number two pick. And guess what? I'm not sure they would have done the De'Aaron Fox trade if they knew that had happened.
Well,
I think because Dylan Harper and De'Aaron Fox, even though they're completely different players, neither of them are great shooters. I don't know. They have to take Harper, it sounds like, but it's a little bit of a weird mix. And then he's throwing Castle too.
It would be so fascinating to be in their meetings right now, because, you know, Fox is late 20s, right? Wembanyama is super young. The rest of the team is super young. Durant's 37. How much of our Wemby timeline are we actually willing to sacrifice for a guy who's, you know, closer to 40 than he is to 30? And how good in the West are we actually? That's what you have to look in the mirror and say. If we have like Fox, Durant, Wembanyama, let's say they even keep Vassell.
Castle.
Who's left on our bench? Like, Sohan is maybe going out in that trade. Barnes is going out in that trade. Is Keldon Johnson going out in that trade? Are we actually a championship contender? Is Wembanyama already that good? Do we know enough about the Fox-Wembanyama fit that in
and
the
West? And can our number two pick play real minutes for us and help us right away?
In the West, can we win three playoff series in the West?
Well, that's why if you do the Durant thing, you're signing him for what? You know, it's for at least 2 years would be my guess.
I
don't understand the
minute. Do you want Durant on a 2-year, $112 million extension?
Takes care of his body.
Would you go to him and be like, hey?
No, I would want him to take less. Because there was like, two options, right? He could take 124 as well. As the 124 made me blink.
He's got to wait, I think, a certain amount of time.
He's got to wait 6 months and he could get that one.
You know, I remember hearing stuff like, you know, as he and his people and the Suns sort of negotiate his post-Phoenix landing spot, which might be the last thing. Like, this might be the last chapter of Kevin Durant's basketball career.
Comes home to Texas.
He should really want to get it right. Would he ever be like, you know, in this second apron era, team X, you're going to be coming up against it. Like, I'll do 2 years, 60.
Or maybe he just wants the 1 year because he wants to play in this goofy rival league that I talked about with Chuck Klosterman the other day. This F1 international basketball league that is, I think, a little closer to actually being real than a lot of people have.
That's a big one
to give it credit for.
It's a big curveball.
I don't think it's not a real thing. I like doing the double knots now. Is it harder to aggregate me?
I mean, let's just imagine. No, I'm not even going to do it. I'm not going to imagine. I'm just going to walk that all the way back before I say it. I'm just saying, Durant taking less is a conversation I would want to have with him. Like, are you actually willing to do this to help us build out this team? Not saying you should.
I brought this up because
I'm saying that I think it's an idea that he's probably thought about himself.
Well, yeah. And also, these guys have made staggering amounts of money on the court and off the court. And at some point, this is what Tom Brady did in the Patriots for the last 10 years he was there, and he made the money back off the court. You mentioned the Clippers for him. And that's how this whole thing started, because I'd heard there was a little Clippers buzz. I can't figure out how it works. There'd have to be a third team. That third team would have to be really excited about acquiring James Harden or Norm Powell and Bogdanovich together.
I think he goes there to play with Harden, Durant.
Okay.
I think that's part of why the Clippers have at least
thought about it. All right, so if I'm the Suns, like, I'm not... Is Zubats in the deal? He's not? Okay, fuck off.
I think that's why, I think that's why the Clippers will not end up with Kevin Durant.
Yeah. So can we just shut that down? Because Zubats isn't going to be in the deal.
I mean,
the Clippers would love to have Kevin Durant.
Shut it down if you
want. Are you going to actually trade something for him? Because you're not getting it from Norm Powell and Batum and Chris Dunn and Bogdanovich and a shitty pick.
You have to really think that the Suns would value the Clippers unprotected 2030 pick, a Clippers unprotected 2031 swap, and a Clippers unprotected 2032 pick. Like, really, just as the Thunder have profited by betting against the Clippers' long-term future, the Suns think... Well,
so you're saying the Suns, the stupidest team in the 21st century since the mid-2000s Knicks,
wow,
with draft picks. Like, nobody has been more reckless and stupid with the concept of future picks. Maybe since Ted Stepien in the 80s, that Bradley Beal trade and all the swaps and shit they did is some of the stupidest shit in the recent history of the league. So you're saying now that they would care about getting swaps with the Clippers? I think that there's no way. I don't think they value draft picks.
The Suns are going to have to look in the mirror and think, and like, we traded present talent, really good present day talent, and really good every pick we had to get Kevin Durant. Now we're trading Kevin Durant, and we're not going to be able to have the buffet of everything that we traded for him. We're going to have to choose on a sliding scale of salary relief, which is very important to us, draft picks, and win now talent, because Devin Booker is still on our team. And we're just not going to check all those boxes to the degree that we want.
No. They spent $10 million on a house that was worth $7 million, and now they have to sell it for $5 million. And that's it. And it was like, well, I should get 10. I paid 10. It's like, you're getting 5.
And look,
that's how this is playing out.
I have no idea what's going to happen with Devin Booker. I really do believe there is that, from what I've heard, that Devin Booker really likes the idea of being a one team player, like a Kobe for Phoenix. He's talked a lot about Kobe Bryant, what he means to him and all that. But if they come out of this trade with something that doesn't excite me for the next 2 or 3 years, like a player that I could be like, oh, that guy's fun to play with. And we know the Beal thing is not going anywhere. You know, he's not a long-term part of the Phoenix Suns' future. I'm looking around, if I'm Devin Booker, like, is there a plan here of any, like, what is happening? Like, and he's already talked about, you know, we were so close in the finals not that long ago, and now, what's happened to our team?
And if you're Matt Ishbia, you have to look in the mirror and you wonder, wait, that's Isaiah Thomas standing right behind me. It doesn't even work for me. Oh, wait, he does. He's my conciliary for some reason, but we're all pretending he's not. Boy, there's some good stories about that one.
It's not great in Phoenix.
Have you heard the stories about how he FaceTimes in the meetings?
No.
Yeah. Might have been a coach interview or two or more. He was on FaceTime in the meeting.
Everybody say Nick rocks. 1, 2, 3, Nick rocks. 1, 2, 3, Jordan Ott rocks. Jordan Ott does rock, by the way. He's going to be a good coach.
I'm putting the odds on Giannis getting traded this summer at minus, not getting traded, at like minus 400.
That's a lot.
I think he stays in Milwaukee, and I think he wants to stay.
They definitely want him to stay.
I think there's going to be less action than people think, because then Garland got the toe surgery, so cross him out.
I wouldn't have traded Garland anyway.
Me neither. Cleveland. I would if you gave me something incredible back for him.
So Giannis is, he's also had a couple tweets about getting back to the finals. I hope we get back to the finals the last couple of days.
He had the interview where he talked about the Bucks getting back to the finals.
I would still go not minus 400. I would go like minus 200 or something.
Okay. Did you see his I miss Woj tweet? I thought that was weird.
Yeah, that didn't really get where.
Does he feel like things are being misreported?
I mean, I miss Woj, but I don't know.
The insinuation from a tweet like that is things are getting misreported, which I actually agree with because he's never said anything other than he's going to be back in Milwaukee. And even when Shams did that weird media thing on that Monday where it's like, he's open to the possibility. It's like, did he ask for a trade? He didn't. So he's open to thinking about the future? Okay, cool. Who doesn't think about the future? It's not a story.
I don't know.
It's a story if he says, Giannis went to the Bucks today and said, I think I'm ready to be traded. But it, by all accounts, he hasn't said that. And by the way, if you're Giannis, I'm watching this Pacers team that is now 2 wins from the finals and has won 14 playoff games. And I'm like, we were right there with those dudes in round one. Right? They lost in 5, but they lost 2 of the stupidest games of the playoffs to them.
Yeah, the only problem
they didn't
with that
have Dame.
Is
after, I'm just, after I'm just round saying, they weren't far away.
Round 2, round 3, and
I get
round
it.
4.
I get it, but I'm saying if I'm Giannis talking myself into Milwaukee, whether it's salvageable, I'd be like,
well, Eric Neem has talked about the gap year concept at The Athletic, and you know, it's an interesting concept. I just don't know, is it a gap year? Like, how do you make it just 1 year when you have very little draft equity at all and not that many?
You're saying no if Dame's out for the year.
Yeah. Like, but how do you make it just 1 year? Like, how do you say, well, by 2026, 27, we're going to be ready to rock again? Like,
so you don't think Kevin Porter and Giannis can be the new big two?
And Kuz?
Rejuvenated Kuz. Taking the summer seriously.
I have a question for you. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
A 1 a.m. question?
Yeah.
I didn't listen to the whole pod with Ryan yet, but someone told me today that you were, and I don't know if this is right, that's why I'm asking you, you were very confident that Philly is going to try to trade the number 3 pick. Is that person summarizing you inaccurately, or?
I am confident that they're exploring all options with the pick.
Well, yeah.
Whether they actually find a trade they like. But I think I'm pretty confident that they're at least. I just think that's how Daryl has operated his entire career.
They should.
He's going to look at every possible option, and then if it makes the most sense to do 3 and Paul George for something or however they want to do it. I think there's some really good dudes in this top 5, though, and when they start working out and talking to them, they're gonna. My guess would be they'll fall in love with one of the guys, and that'll be that. There's a guy. I've started to do my work. There's 2 guys that I think you're really going to dig. This Edgecombe.
Yeah, I've watched them. I've watched
easily
I've
could have
YouTube
played in the game we watched today and at least just athletically hung in. Yeah. And then this Trey Johnson could be pretty exciting as an offensive. He's 6'4". They have to decide Maxi McCain. If you're adding a third, like 6'3 to 6'5 guy to that, then what does that mean? Is McCain your 6th man? I mean, you could look at Indiana.
You got to resign Grimes, too. Like, Grimes is something.
Right. But, I mean, you look at the Indiana model, it's like the more guards, the better, in my opinion. Just the way basketball is going, so.
But Indiana's guards are big and tough, other than, you know, Halliburton is not like Halliburton skinny, but, like, he's still tall. Nembhard's tough. Mathurin's tough. Neesmith.
Have you changed your who's in the best situation for the next 5 years in the East answer? Now that we've gotten further along in the finals, because you did a thing with Waz after I talked to Ryan about it.
I had Indiana.
And I said
2,
Indiana was
Cleveland 1.
You had Cleveland 1. Ryan had Cleveland 1. I think Waz had Cleveland 1.
Look, if they win the championship, it's just you just win. Like, you win all the polls. So, yes, if they win, I guess I would have to.
It's
they're
funny
up 2-1 in the finals. They're a championship caliber
team. I thought Ryan made a good case. I think Waz made a good, or you and Waz both made. The Cleveland case, I think, is the right answer because
it's the only other candidate.
You have the most options with Mobley, Garland, and Mitchell. Even if it's not working out with those as your best 3 and Allen, they still have a lot of different things they could do. that would be why. But if Indiana wins the title.
Yeah. If you win the title, you just win all the polls for a little while. That's all. And they're, even if they don't win the title, I will say, if Oklahoma City wins the next three games, Indiana has proven itself a championship caliber team.
And then you have Boston a year ago. It's in Dallas. Wondering if this would be the first of a couple titles. Now Jaylen Brown shaving his meniscus. Jason Tatum, day 27 of Achilles rehab. Jrue Holiday, Porzingis trade rumors. I don't know what happened.
I mean, do we know what happened with Porzingis
at all? Then
we're
in a hotel room in Indiana with you at 1 a.m. talking about Kevin Durant, if he likes Texas or not. What happened to my Celtics life?
I mean, we don't even know what happened to Porzingis. Like,
still don't know. Yeah, would love an answer on that at some point. Some sort of medical verdict.
It's yeah.
Did anything happen?
The ultimate team. Look, we're getting a little groggy now, but the ultimate team, when you say like, what happened to us? We're just like looking around like, what? How did we get here? Is Sacramento. Just looking around like, how did we become the Bulls? Like the mediocre Bull, that's who we are now. And like, but with Sabonis, how is this our team? Like Zach LaVine makes how much? DeMar DeRozan's like around doing stuff. Malik Monk's our point guard. What happened?
How about we had Halliburton?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, how did we get here? The Beam team was so fun.
God, I hated that trade for them.
What happened?
I think I went, I haven't heard the pot of it about it, but I think I said, I think I went all in on that one. That I thought it was a massive mistake by them. Because, you know, when we talk about stuff after a thing, and I'm like, I think this, I think that. And then occasionally it's like, I feel so strongly about this. I want to put some, can you put this down in pen? I just couldn't believe they traded him.
So let's go back to, now we're really.
And by the way, the Sabonis thing, they got good value. And turned out it was a good trade for both sides. I get it. But I just never, ever would have traded him.
Not a win-win. The ultimate one, though, you put, and many people put their flag down most aggressively on, was Gobert. And so it's interesting to think now, like...
I still have no regrets on that one.
I don't think you should. It is undeniable that they have gotten further as a franchise than they have ever gotten before 2 years in a row. And yet it still feels like, how? Like, they gave up so much to get him. But, like...
I will say this. The one thing I was definitely wrong about, and I remember saying this as a critique of the trade, was you do that trade when Anthony Edwards is like 24, 25, and he's close to hitting his prime. I think the thing they saw that I guess none of us saw was that he was way closer to
that was the bet.
A top seven guy than I think we thought.
And the really interesting thing about it was part of the reason that a lot of us didn't like that trade at first blush and even at second and third blush was, well, it's just, you're just inevitably going to have to trade Towns because the salary crunch is just, you're just not going to be able to have these guys. And he's the obvious guy. Like, you're not, obviously you're not going to trade Ant.
Oh man, we didn't talk about the real topic of the finals, the Knicks coaching search.
Oh my God.
The fact that the Knicks are back.
Quinn Snyder.
This whole thing where you just ask for permission for people who are under contract, I've never heard of
such a thing.
Let's
go through. It's
Quinn. They did everybody but Steve Kerr and Spoelstra.
Quinn Snyder, Billy Donovan, Ime Udoka, Chris Finch. I think we're even missing one.
Jason Kidd.
That's the one I was missing. At this point, if you're a coach and they haven't, it's like, boy, do I suck? Like, why are the Knicks calling about
me?
Yeah,
it has hit that point where you start to, you start to wonder, is it you? I don't know what they do. If I were them, I would just hire Taylor Jenkins. I thought he was a really good coach. And I think you could explain his lack of success in Memphis. Or, I mean, he was successful, but...
Can you say control Z on the Tibbs thing? It's like, hey.
The papers aren't handed in yet.
I saw the ad in the Times that you placed. The message, a little letter in the Times. Really touching. Really, really tugged on my heartstrings.
Wait, is Taylor Jenkins, what was wrong with him?
Nothing. I just think that if you're the New York Knicks and you've made the conference finals, you fired your coach, who's this 67-year-old veteran, whatever he is, coach, with a mandate to win the championship, I just don't think you're going to the guy who was in the like little small market over here. Like, I don't think James Dolan even knows who Taylor Jenkins is. I think Taylor Jenkins is an awesome coach, and he would be toward the top of my list, if not at the top of it too.
Because even he has the ready-made explanation of, yeah, things were going really well, and then crazy shit started happening with my star player. Oh, and Brandon Clark was my glue guy, and he just kept getting season-ending injuries.
I can't believe the name that I'm surprised hasn't come up is Vogel. Just because veteran coach,
yeah,
likable personality, New York area ties. And I was talking to some people about that today. And the word retread came up, like too much of a retread. I'm like, well, okay. I think that's a little unfair to him because like Phoenix is just, I just think everyone yeah. gets a pass for getting fired in Phoenix. It's yeah, almost like a badge of honor.
It's like the zookeeper in a zoo where the bears attacked a lion. And it's like, well, it was the zookeeper's fault.
Well, and also they at least like made the playoffs. And the Lakers, he wins a championship, gets fired amid the Russ disaster. And like, you know,
I think Vogel's a good coach.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm surprised that name hasn't come up. A lot of the dots make sense of just like veteran coach.
How funny is it going to be when they hire Mike Woodson?
You could. Not that funny to Knicks fans. I don't know.
Would you bet your life that they wouldn't hire Mike Woodson?
I wouldn't bet my life on anything Knicks related. They just called six coaches in 24 hours just for fun. Hey, Atlanta. No?
They were so competent. Also, like, whoever gets the job has to keep the best player's dad on the team as an assistant coach. Not exactly, like, enticing. So I get to coach in the New York Fishbowl. I'm expected to win a title. There's a weird coaching staff situation that, by the way, a lot of people are talking about underneath in the undergrounds. It's not great.
Here's the question. If you were Leon Rose or whoever's making the calls, let's just say Leon Rose.
Yeah.
Would you even have the guts, the gall, the audacity to call Pat Riley? Would just to do it like, hey, we got to check the spell box. Like, we got to see. Like, well, don't we have to see? Given Riley's history with
him, I thought Spo.
Would you even do it just to do it?
I house threw out Spo initially when this all started.
You screenshotted his text.
I thought he seemed miserable last season. That was the only thing about it that made me pause for a second.
See, I disagree with you on one level. When they were losing, what did they have, like an 8 or 9 game losing streak at some point when it was all coming apart for them? And he, in one of the press conferences, said, you know, like, actually, I love this. Like, I love that we have to get together as a group and dig out of this. That's not like Spo speak. He really loves, like,
well, not only did they not
solve
dig out,
this problem.
Not only did they not dig out, they had like an embarrassing exit.
Yeah, it wasn't great. The Cavs just traipsing all over Miami and Max Strus. And
so if I was Miami, I would all time blow it up. I would trade Bam. I wouldn't do the Hero extension. I would trade Spo to the Knicks. I would just completely blow it up.
Spo's getting.
Yeah, I'd completely blow it up. It seems like they're going to go the other way and like they're kicking the tires on Durant too.
I was just imagining the most preposterous phone call possible is Leon Rose calling Pat Riley about Eric Spoelstra. That's the most preposterous thing. I'm really rooting for that to come out.
Well, considering they've called everybody else, like, would you be shocked?
I would be a little shocked.
We have to go because now my head's starting to hurt.
Yeah.
So we're going to come back on Friday night on your podcast.
Yeah.
The Zach Lowe Show. We're not going to be live, but we're going to come after game 4. We're going to do the exact same setup. Hopefully we figure out. We'll learn from the kinks. We only had one stop and start this time around. We're going to do that and it'll be up on your YouTube channel as well. This will be on my YouTube channel. This will be a video podcast on Spotify as well.
Hopefully everything worked.
Yeah, hopefully everything worked. Thanks to Gahao and Eduardo as well for producing for us. And thanks to Zach Lowe. I'll see you in Indy tomorrow. But
yeah, we're here.
Game 4, real stakes.
Love a great game.
What did we
4.
Say? Magical or?
Calamity or magical?
Calamity or magical. Got to work on that.
That's every Pacers game is calamity. Like, they've had 5 calamity or magical games in one playoff run. Was game 1 against the Knicks a calamity or magical? Magical. I'm going magical across the board.
What a great place this is. All right. I'll see you tomorrow in Indiana.
Boom.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. For Kansas, and affiliation with Kansas Star Casino, or 18 plus and present in D.C. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. Call 1-888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut, or visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland. Hope is here. Visit gamblinghelpline ma.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts, or call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in New York.